Welcome into a brand new Call It podcast, recording Tuesday, January 26th, bottom of the 12 o'clock hour here in Boston. I'm Alex Barth, as always, joined by Alex Lebowitz. We're powered by CLNS Media. What's up, Lebowitz?
Not much. How are you doing?
I'll tell you this. I am grappling with some feelings today.
Oh, yeah?
And yesterday. And Sunday night, because Tom Brady is going to his 10th Super Bowl, but it's his first without the Patriots. And, I look at it like, so somebody asked me after the game, like, who am I rooting for? And Tom Brady's my childhood quarterback. I've rooted for him my whole life. I love the guy. Like, I don't hold it against him leaving New England, any of that. Like, I want him to win. I want him to be successful. I want him to be happy. At the same time, I feel like if he wins a Super Bowl in Tampa, like everybody compared it to him leaving to Joe Montana going to the Chiefs. And like Joe Montana, nobody thinks of Joe Montana when they think, or nobody thinks of the Chiefs when they think of Joe Montana, right? But he never won there. And now it's starting to look like, you know, Peyton Manning doesn't go to Colts games anymore. Peyton Manning is not involved with the Colts. Like, he is a Bronco, and that sucks. Because he played there for like 4 years, two of them good, and won one title versus a decade plus with the Colts. Like, if Brady wins a Super Bowl with the Bucs, and outside of the game next year where they play here, does he ever set foot in Foxborough again?
Yeah, no, I think so. Time heals all wounds. And I think you can look at the separation between Brady and Belichick as a wound. And at some point, I think it's illogical to think that they won't look back with admiration for each other. And they probably do now. But again, that experience with each other is so fresh. And I feel like they needed a split. But when it comes to Brady's relationship with the Patriots organization, that's going to stem back to Robert Kraft more than it is Bill Belichick. And Brady and his post-game
press. So I guess let me rephrase the question. Let's say Tom Brady gets inducted into the Patriots Hall of Fame while Bill's still the coach. Does he show up at the induction, or does he record just like a 30-second video for the big screen?
Oh, no, he's there. He's there. I don't think – I think people have this idea in their head that Brady is looking on at what – or Belichick is looking on at what Brady's doing, and he's like in a fit of rage. I don't think that's the case. I think there is a genuine aspect to the Bill Belichick mindset. Well, it probably hurts to see Brady go off and do very good things with Tampa Bay. I don't think he dwells over it. And I don't think he holds anything personally against Brady. I think if anything, it would be Brady that holds something personal against Belichick for not giving him the treatment that he thinks was warranted. So when it comes down to it, I think they're both guys who have a really good head on their shoulders. And they'll be able to look at this in perspective at some point. And if, the Bucs win in the Super Bowl, Brady will add to his legacy, but he's always going to be a Patriot. And I think there's always going to be mutual respect, not only between him and the Patriots organization, obviously, but him and Belichick. I also think next season could change a lot of things in regard to where the Patriots are and kind of, moving along in this separation process between Bill and Tom. So we'll see what happens. But as a Patriots fan, as someone who grew up rooting for Tom Brady, I'm rooting for him again. I want him to win. I would love to see him win another Super Bowl, going to his 10th. I mean, it's really incredible what we're watching. And I for the life of me, I can't look at this in a negative way. I can't look at it, and be, somewhat heartbroken. I think that the separation was inevitable. And I think for Patriots fans, mental health, the sake of their mental health, they need to understand that was just an inevitability. And it happened when it happened, because that's just how it works. I don't think it's worth looking too deep into it.
Yeah. I don't know. So take the video he did with Gronk after the game, right? Where it's what's the song? I'm blanking on the name.
It's of song. We Ain't
by 50
Going
Cent. Yeah.
Nowhere.
Yeah. Bad Boys. Bad Boys for Life. That's what it is. And we all know what that's in reference to, right? The video they did after the 2018 AFC Championship game, and it's like, it doesn't feel like he's trying to leave a new legacy in Tampa. It feels like he's trying to overwrite his Patriots legacy. in some ways. Like, that's what that video was. It was like, we don't need to go back and watch the one we did when we were on the Patriots, because now we have the same video when we're on the Bucks. And by the way, I don't feel the same about Gronk as I do about Brady. I think a huge reason the Patriots are in the spot they're in right now is because Gronk dragged out his retirement for no reason in the spring of 2018 or the spring of 2019. So I'm rooting for Brady. I'm not rooting for Gronk.
There could have been clarity on Gronk's part. But that's an individual.
The whole thing ties back to that. Because if he retires before free agency, which some of it's on Belichick, he should have put a deadline in there. If he retires before free agency, they don't drag their feet on the cap. They go out, they sign Jared Cook. They have a competent offense in 2019. They don't have to force the issue with Antonio Brown. They don't force the issue with Antonio Brown. That whole schism doesn't develop. They also save themselves $9 million. They can go out and actually put pieces around Brady last year. And maybe, kind of change his mind about leaving. So the whole thing to me, pretty much all of the Patriots issues, especially on the offensive side of the ball the last 2 years, go back to Rob Gronkowski dragging out his retirement, which, by the way, was obvious. He knew it after that Super Bowl. He just dragged it out. But all of the Patriots offensive issues can be tied back to Rob Gronkowski dragging out his retirement in 2019.
Well, yeah, I think winning cures all tension. And if the Patriots finished last season stronger than they did and maybe went to a conference championship, maybe things would have been different. But I think even with Jared Cook, you got to bring in an Antonio Brown. If Antonio Brown, you could say it's Antonio Brown's fault. If he's not an idiot, he stays on the team.
Antonio Brown's fault. But here's the thing. They were put into a situation where they were forced to sign a wild card, where they were forced to bring dynamite into that locker room.
Jared Cook wouldn't have been the difference.
So. But it wasn't just Jared Cook. Jared Cook's the example because they get the replacement tight end, but they go out to get, like, by the time they knew that they weren't going to have Rob Gronkowski, which they should have known before, but by the time they didn't, there were no options. You're right. You needed multiple people to replace Rob Gronkowski, but it was too late to go out and get a quality wide receiver. It was too late to go out and get a quality tight end. You get stuck with Ryan Izzo. You get stuck with Matt LaCoste. Like, I'm just throwing Jared Cook out there because he was the name at the time, but it would have been more than one guy. They saved, I think, $15 million against the cap by Rob Gronkowski retiring. Cook signed for, I want to say, $9 million. So that's, $5 million. You're not signing DeAndre Hopkins, but you're getting a player. You're getting, not N'Keal Harry. You're getting who else were the bums on that team that they had catching the ball? For this year, whatever, you're getting better than Dante Moncrief for $5 million. So
you're getting better than Mohamed Sanu for a second round pick.
Mohamed Sanu, thank you. Exactly. Yes. There you go. That's the name I was looking
for. They were in a desperate situation because of Gronk. I'm not going to fault him for taking his time on a personal decision. I don't think he owed anything to anyone but himself when it comes to,
I think it would have been perfectly fair for the Patriots to say, free agency starts March 17th. Mm-hmm. We need to know by March 10th. I think that would have been perfectly fair. Yeah. Teams do things like that all the time. It's not uncommon. It's one thing if they went to him the day after the Super Bowl and said, do you want to retire?
But wouldn't that have just alienated Brady even more? Like, it's like you're treating, the best tight end in NFL history like this.
I don't think so. I think that that's perfectly fair. And if anything, I think you put the prerogative on Brady in that case to convince Rob Gronkowski to come back. No, I think that helps Brady. The whole thing that we've heard is that he was complained that they weren't prepared. That's how you get prepared. Mm-hmm. It might have ticked him off in the short term, but I think long term he ends up happier if they put a deadline on Rob Gronkowski in February 2019.
The turning point for this relationship, I think, all stems back to Jimmy Garoppolo and Belichick being overridden by Robert Kraft in regard to potentially dealing Tom Brady. And that was it. Without that, you're not in this situation right now. Without that, the Rob Gronkowski stuff doesn't matter in relation to Brady being on this team and Brady's relationship with Belichick being what it became. So I think it's just Bill Belichick. Again, the things that make him such a great head coach in football mind, the thing that sustained the success for 20 years eventually ended up costing him a relationship with this, the other most important factor in this success. And it's, you just got to, you got to take it. You got to take the bad with the good, you know? So, again, this was an inevitability. This was just a storm building. And for it not to happen, you would have had to had Bill Belichick go against the very person he is from a head coaching and general manager standpoint. And that wasn't going to happen. This is just natural. And Brady wants to play as long as he can. He went to a position, to a team that was already stacked, that had pieces in place, that had a way more talented offense than anything he's dealt with in New England over the past 3 or 4 years. And it's worked out. So I think you can point out a lot of different factors and try to, you know, look back and see what may have gone wrong in this process. But for me, I'm not going to overthink it. I think this is just the way relationships work. And there's never been a head coach and quarterback who have sustained the amount of success they had. It came to an end. It just came to an end naturally, I think. And now that quarterback, our childhood hero, is in the Super Bowl, and I'm going to be rooting for him. And I personally, as much as I'd rather have the Patriots be there, I'm still happy. It's still a rooting interest, and I want to see him win another one.
Yeah, I just, you know, to go back to something you said before, you were talking about how, you know, you think that they're just Brady and Belichick are level-headed. They can take the emotion out of it and they'll be back. But like, that was my logic for Brady coming back this offseason. And emotion got in the way. So like now that's on the table. Now emotion is on the table with these guys. So yeah, I don't know. It'll be interesting. I'm rooting for him. It's like, you know, it's like rooting for like an ex that you're not over yet, you know, where it's like, you know, if you see they're with somebody and they're happy, like the right thing to do is say, you know, oh, good for them. I'm glad they're happy. But like deep down, you're like, I want it to fail. You know what I mean? Like that. Not that I'm a bitter person or anything.
Yeah,
because I have people who know my exes who listen to this podcast, and I'm not at that point with any of them. I want to throw that out there.
Yeah,
but you know, it's really like, you know, I want him to win. I do. I want him to win. But like deep down, I'm like, you know, I'm just thinking about, you know, when he retires and ESPN tweets the picture of him with the rings on his finger, and six of them have Patriots logos, and then one or two of them have Bucks logos. And it just nauseates me. Like that's what I can't like. It's selfish.
Yeah,
I'm rooting for him. For him, I'm rooting against him for me.
Yes, and I understand exactly where you're coming from. And I'll also say this in regard to the respect point I made. I'm talking specifically about looking back and the legacy and what they did together. Right. I think they'll be able to put all this behind them and understand, you know, it's a business. And I think they both already go about it with that mentality. He felt disrespected, though, Brady, because he thought he earned – certain privileges, and Belichick remained consistent, and maybe he shouldn't have, but it's the way Belichick is. I'll make one more comparison. When Paul Pierce played for the Washington Wizards, the I called game, that quote, that was awesome to watch. I didn't have any animosity towards him, and I don't think I was rooting for him as much as I'm rooting for Tom Brady to win another one.
I think the Paul Pierce situation is different, because like, you know, if Brady leaving meant the Patriots got the football equivalent of Jason Tatum, this would be a lot easier. But, you know, we didn't get Justin Herbert.
Walked.
We got Cam Newton. So, you know, we didn't get the Jason. That's like the Nets trade if the Celtics didn't get any picks. They only got Chris Humphries and Gerald Wallace.
And like, so maybe Ray Allen. Maybe Ray Allen's better. Maybe Ray Allen's a better example.
Yeah, well,
but even Ray Allen, I don't blame for what he did. He ended up.
Oh no, I totally blame Ray Allen.
He made the right decision.
Money. He took less money to leave and didn't tell anybody he was leaving. No, well, that was bad.
He won a ring, and he got what he wanted. So from a personal standpoint, you can't fault him because he was right. I mean, that's just a fact. So and Brady, guess what?
But he went about it the wrong way, and I don't think Brady did everything right. But Allen left on the worst possible terms. He turned his back. We talk about players who change teams being traitors, and that's usually hyperbole in sport. But no, he left for less money. He didn't discuss it with anybody. He didn't tell his teammates. They just found out watching the news. That's wrong. When you build what Ray Allen built with with Paul Pierce and Kevin Garnett in Boston, and you leave without a word, that's wrong. That's a human being. That's wrong.
So Brady did he met with Robert Kraft before he went public and signed the paperwork saying, hey, I'm leaving. He did it the right way. And I'm sure he was corresponding with certain teammates.
I would not put Tom Brady in the Ray Allen category. And there are people who are, and that's wrong. Ray Allen goes in the Johnny Damon. He's worse than Damon because at least Damon took the money. Vinatieri took the money. He took a chance to go indoors and break records. Ray Allen took a shot at one ring as a reserve, getting paid the minimum as a Hall of Famer who is still relatively capable. Disgraceful. I don't want to go down this road too much because you'll get me off Ray Allen.
Yeah.
So what we'll do. So that's the thoughts on the Bucks game. We're just going to react to these games this week. We'll do the Super Bowl preview itself next week. So let's go over to the other game now, and the Chiefs and the Bills. And here's more. These are more pleasant, conflicting emotions. I was a little disappointed because I thought we'd get a little more of a game, but I was very happy the Bills finally got curb stomped. Like, I'm on record. Was it last week, 2 weeks ago? I went on that rant about I don't root for underdogs because they're stupid. Like, that's what should happen to underdogs. That's exactly what should happen. And I'll tell you this, the Bills did that to themselves. What the hell was that field goal at the end of the first half? The hell was that? You were in Kansas City facing a generational offense on, what, the 6-yard line, and you think you could walk away with 3 points? Three's closer to zero than it is to seven. Pathetic. And you know what? The best, worst part about it, that what is the term? Schadenfreude? Where, like, you get pleasure out of somebody else's pain, right? The Schadenfreude in that was what made the Bills so good all year was they were the most aggressive team in football. That's what made them so good. It's what made them so electric to watch. It's what got them to that point. They were super aggressive. And that's the moment you choose to say, well, let's take the 3 points. That's the spot. That's pathetic. And I'll tell you this. You know, I had a talk, Jesse Feldman, friend of the show, noted Bills fan. I kind of had to talk him down off the ledge after the game. Or he called me like 1 a.m. to cheer me up. That's 2 years in a row the Bills have choked in the playoffs. This is a pattern now. They blew, what was it, a 28-point lead to Houston last year, right? And then they come out and they're up 9-0 on the Chiefs and they have all the momentum and they kick a field goal from the 6-yard line against that team in that building. I don't know that Sean McDermott's up to it. And this is, and I know I'm kind of taking it all here. One more point, and then I'll let you go. You look at some of these coaches that have been hailed as geniuses for their scheming, right? I know he wasn't in the playoffs this year, but we're going to put Kyle Shanahan in this group. Stefanski in Cleveland last week. You've got LaFleur in Green Bay. And the defensive side of the ball was kind of the same thing in McDermott. Oh, they're brilliant. Oh, they can scheme, blah, blah, blah. They have all been pantsed in the postseason in terms of their game management. It's happened twice to Shanahan. He has 28-3 on his resume. You saw Stefanski with that pathetic drive at the end of the game against the Chiefs last week. LaFleur kicking his BS field goal against the Bucks, right? And that management and that, we're going to play it safe. And then you have McDermott now with two collapses on his resume. The most underrated element of coaches right now is their ability to make in-game decisions situationally. The coaching throughout this playoffs has been putrid. We saw it again last week, and that's honestly why I have hope for the Patriots. Because once Bill Belichick does get talent again, because he didn't have it this year, once he does get his hands on some talent, he's not going to make these mistakes that every other team is making. And when it comes to the Bills, this is a pattern now. And I see them saying next year, like they'll get it next year. They've learned their lesson. A 3-year window in the NFL is massive. This might have been it. You're going to have the Chargers are going to be competitors next year. The Broncos, whichever team lands Deshaun Watson, the Patriots might be back. You're not going to cakewalk the AFC again next year. So, yeah, Sean McDermott, and I see people talking about Josh Allen didn't play great or whatever. Sean McDermott deserves the majority of the blame for that loss because he coached scared, and that's why his team lost that game.
Yeah, they had a 9-point lead and they blew it, and the Chiefs just didn't look back. I think we got to give credit to the Chiefs. They're an unbelievable football team.
Sure.
It's tough to stop that offense. They're exceptionally talented. I don't think the coaching was great. I think Josh Allen did not perform all that well. He constantly takes these horrendous sacks. Learn how to throw the ball away or just take the sack. You know, 5 to 10 yards behind the line of scrimmage instead of 25 yards behind the line of scrimmage. The guy takes his team out of field goal range more than anyone in the NFL. It really is unbelievable. I understand he's an incredible talent, but you got to learn the basics. Those are rookie mistakes that he's continuing to make year three in the NFL. That's a problem, and it's not to minimize the accomplishments he's had this season, but when it's crunch time, you got to be able to be smart with the football. And throughout this postseason, there's been a couple times where he's just taken horrible sacks and been brutal with decision making. I do think the Bills are here to stay. I think that's a great football team. They're obviously going to be the favorites in the AFC East next year. That said, there's going to be a ton of moving parts. Deshaun Watson, if he goes to the Jets, that's a potential 10-win team. With him being on that roster and all the cap space they have alone, the Patriots, they get Matthew Stafford.
Deshaun Watson on the Jets is a 10-win team?
I think they're an 8-win team probably, but it depends what they do with that cap space.
If Deshaun Watson on the Jets is a 10-win team, you must have the Dolphins putting up a perfect season if they get
it. I think the Dolphins with Deshaun Watson, it's a 12-win team, potentially, definitely, easily. I mean,
you think the gap in the roster between the Dolphins and Jets is 2 games?
No, I'm more banking on the Jets doing something this offseason, given the fact that they have the second most cap space in the NFL. So I think they're going to make a lot. If you bring Deshaun Watson in, your destination.
You think there's more room to grow with the Jets than the Dolphins, essentially?
I think the Dolphins have a much more complete roster as is. And if I were Deshaun Watson, I'm going there instead of New York. There's no question about it. But if I'm Deshaun Watson and I go to the Jets, I think there's a lot of opportunities there, especially if Robert Saleh or Saleh, however the hell you pronounce it, if he pans out to be a quality head coach. Point being, yeah, I mean, the Bills, I'm not counting them out. They've continued to improve the last 3 years, going from, you know, what they were last year to being in the conference championship. That's big. The problem is, you know, teams have had to you know, fight the Patriots, Tom Brady and the Patriots over the past 2 decades. Now it's Patrick Mahomes and the Chiefs. So I don't think this is a Bills problem. I think this is an AFC problem that's going to be really tough to overcome over the next few years. But the Bills are in as good of a position as anybody. We'll see what happens this offseason. I'm not sure who's up for free agency. Stephon Diggs will be back. That's all I know. And Josh Allen is going to be a year older. So, I'm not counting them out. I think they could have played better, but at the end of the day, the Chiefs are just a really good football team, and the better team won.
See, I just think, like, yeah, no, the better team absolutely won, and I'm all for that, as I've stated. I just think, you know, I look at the Bills, and there's been a team every year and a quarterback every year too, and they're not always on the same team. Like, the quarterback doesn't always play for the team. Sometimes they do, but, you know, the 2017 Jaguars are the poster child for this, where – you know, you talk about them as, oh, yeah, no, this is it. This is right. We heard for years, the next Patriots, the team that ends the dynasty, right? It was the Colts. Then it was the Broncos. Then it was the Ravens. Then it was like the Broncos again. And then, we went round and round, and the Chiefs finally got there more from attrition than anything else. But, like, remember when the 2017 Jaguars were like, oh, look out, Jacksonville's arrived. Duval, right? They were doing that.
Yeah.
And the team won, like, 3 games the next year, right? And then the Rams in 2018, and Sean McVay was brilliant, and he fixed Jared Goff, and they had all this talent, and the Rams were about to, you know, put LA on the map. They made the playoffs this year, but, like, they're okay, right? And Jared Goff got benched for John Warford. We, you know, he hurt his thumb, sure, but he got benched. We all know what happened. Mm-hmm. So that was 2018, and then last year you had the Ravens, and they regressed, and they still made the playoffs, but they barely snuck in, and they kind of got exposed in that game against the Bills. So I look at it next year, and who's that team next year? Who takes a step back, and which quarterback takes a step back next year? And I think it's the Bills. I do. I don't think they're going to be bad. I think they'll make the playoffs. But, I think 8 to 10 wins is a lot more realistic than 12.
They're going to have a – you know, yeah.
I look at Josh Allen, and everybody talked about he stopped making these bonehead mistakes. He stopped making these game-changing mistakes. He didn't stop. He wasn't for a little bit, but that Josh Allen's still in there, and he came out in the AFC Championship. He showed up for the AFC Championship. So, you know, I just think that I think that the way the team kind of collapsed at the end there mentally, and they're picking the fights, and Stephon Diggs had to be carried off the field because he was trying to start something, like, you know, again, that reminded me of 2017 Jaguars a lot. I just I look at that team and they looked fragile to me. They looked fragile when they came off the field there. So I don't think they're going back to the basement. I think they're going to be a factor, but you know, do they win the AFC East next year? Here's the thing with the AFC East. So who'd they have to go through this year? Whatever's left of Cam Newton, which isn't much.
Mm-hmm.
The weird Tua Fitzpatrick thing in Miami, which was never consistent, and whatever the hell the Jets want to call their quarterback situation. So really they went through like between the three teams, like 1.5 capable quarterbacks, maybe. Next year, there's a non-zero chance that that turns into Deshaun Watson, Justin Fields, Matthew Stafford.
Yeah.
That looks a lot different. Josh Allen goes from being the best quarterback in the division to the third. All right, not Deshaun Watson, sorry. Josh Allen goes from being the best quarterback in the division to the third. Maybe the fourth, depending on what Fields looks like. So, you know, I don't think the Bills should be talking about we'll get him next year. I think that that's very premature.
I think he'd be the second. I still think I'm a Josh Allen believer. I am. I think that as you get older, those mistakes become less and less prevalent. And again, the consistent improvement in his play, it's a good sign. It's a good sign. And next season, no doubt, it's going to be a much tougher division, which in turn is going to make it a much tougher path for the Bills, especially if you get Deshaun Watson in the AFC East. And Matthew Stafford for that matter, but he's still a good quarterback and they still have a very skilled offense. And, those mistakes are fixable. I think they are. You don't have to take 25 yard sacks. And at some point you have to imagine he'll stop doing that at some point.
But for me, at some point was the AFC championship game. If you can't play your best game in that game, mm-hmm. I can't buy into the fact that these changes are permanent.
Sure, but it's year three, and he's gotten better every single season. Gotten way better every single season. So the guy's proven he can change his game and that he can improve and that he's coachable. Like, he's not where he is unless, you know, the coaching is doing its job in Buffalo. So
goes back to my point of, like, I don't know that Sean McDermott's the guy that puts the Bills over the top.
Maybe
they need to get, I'm not saying that they should fire him, but they need to get an assistant head coach in there who's like an expert on like in-game situational coaching, timeouts, mm-hmm. kicking field goals versus going for it, you know, going for two, that kind of thing. Like he clearly needs help with that.
Yeah. And so do the Green Bay Packers, evidently.
And so do like 30 teams. No, you're not wrong. No, that's been the biggest takeaway from the playoffs. The coaching, there's really no exceptions. The coaching has been putrid in every single game. I hate it, but it gives me hope for the Patriots because Belichick, we know, can do the situational thing. So again, we'll do the Super Bowl preview. We'll talk about the Bucs and the Chiefs next week. It's the beauty of the 2 weeks here because there is other stuff I want to get to, Lebowitz, and we are kind of up against it. Let's start with this. We spent, I think, like two of the last three shows, we kind of closed lamenting that baseball's off season there wasn't one. Nothing was happening, and better late than never. I'd still like to see it happen earlier, but we have some movement here. We have some movement, including, let's start with this, a very rare trade between the Red Sox and the Yankees, just the second since 1997, the first since the Stephen Drew blockbuster of 2014. And I love this trade for the Red Sox. I love it for a couple of reasons. I think Adam Ottavino's good. I think his rough statistical season last year was due to one bad performance. You know, in a 60-game season, if you're a reliever, look, I'm not saying an outing where you allow six earned runs is encouraging, but you take out a six-run outing and his three-run outing, and over 22 games, he had an ERA of 1.5. Like, the guy can still pitch. I think Frank German, the prospect they get, is encouraging as well. And I see people saying, you know, so first of all, the Yankees did a salary dump. That in itself is ridiculous. Yeah. They gave up a good reliever just so Brett Gardner can retire with the Yankees. If the Red Sox did that, we would be tearing them a new one. Monumentally stupid. And I see people saying, why would you bail the Yankees out? You're the Red Sox. Why would you help the Yankees? This and that. You know, they were going to find a taker for that deal. Like I said, Adam Ottavino can pitch. If your chief rival is going to essentially give away players and give away prospects, why shouldn't you be the one that benefits? Why not? They were going to free up that cap space one way or the other. You might as well be the team that takes advantage of it. So I love this move from Chaim Bloom. It's funny. I wrote about Bloom the day before, and you can check this piece out on 98.5thesportshub.com. you know, it's a no-brainer. I was getting ripped for it being super obvious, but I wanted to put it out there, you know, Bloom being the anti-Dombrowski. And it wasn't so much pointing that out as kind of laying out the arguments for which process should Red Sox fans prefer. Mm-hmm. But that was not a typical Bloom move. That was an aggressive move, and I like that.
Yeah, and they had the cap space, so like there's no excuse not to when you look at their bullpen and the lack of production out of their bullpen over the last two seasons. This is a great deal. Forget about Frank German or Jermaine, however the hell you pronounce it.
I thought it was German. I just realized I haven't seen it out loud.
It might be Jermaine. I know there's
no. So they have Domingo German. The Yankees do too, but the two aren't related.
Yes. They're just the same last name. Either way, leave that guy out of it. It's a prospect. You know, maybe he ends up being good, maybe not.
Don't. Because all the baseball insider people are saying he's really the gem here. That really? Ottavino, maybe you get a year out of him, but he's the guy. He throws 98. He had a great year in 2019 in the minors, like wildly surpassed expectations. Didn't pitch in 2020 because there was no minor league baseball, but he's 6'2", he throws 98, he can still be a starter or a reliever. Like, everybody's saying that this guy is the guy in this deal, that Ottavino's the throw-in. So I wouldn't throw him out the window. You know, look at Eduardo Rodriguez, right? He was kind of a throw-in in a deal from the Orioles, another interdivision trade, and now he's the Red Sox top starting pitcher. So if this guy can come out for 5 years, not starting this year, but whenever he gets to the majors, he's a couple years away, he's 23, but if he comes out and has like 5 years of putting up solid starts against the Yankees, we're going to remember that a hell of a lot more than Adam Ottavino on, you know, an 85, like as a middle reliever on an 85 win team.
Yeah. And either way, I mean, so it's a great deal all the way around. You get that throw in for taking on the Ottavino contract. And Ottavino is going to be a contributor. I think the Yankees, again, trying to dump some cap space, and getting rid of a guy who was pretty consistent for them. Well, he was a Yankee with the exception of last year, although last year's numbers are obviously deceiving.
Just that one game, right?
Just that one or two games in which he kind of imploded, but they needed this. And it's a good splash. You match that with Garrett Richards, who's, you know, not a great signing, but it's someone who it might be worth taking a risk on. You want to see more done, though, especially with that pitching staff. Kike Hernandez, nice little addition, not a world changer. So there's still room to improve. But overall, I think, you know, you got to be a fool to not love this Ottavino trade.
Yeah, no. And again, because it's just like everybody was waiting. You mentioned the Hernandez deal, like 2 years, $14 million. OK, probably overpaid a little bit, but like he'll be the second baseman. They bring in Garrett Richards, whatever. You know, he'll make 10 starts before he gets hurt. Like, fine. This was the first like, oh, OK.
Yeah.
Like, hello. Welcome to the table. Like, this was the first defining move of Chaim Bloom's Red Sox career. Well, outside of the Mookie Betts trade, but that's its own thing. To me, the Chaim Bloom era started after the Mookie Betts trade. Like, that was leftover cleaning up Dave Dombrowski's mess. Now he's doing it. Now Bloom's doing his own thing. And that was the first, to me, that's his like first real move. And, you know, again, I don't think they're contenders this year, but I think he's put together an interesting roster. I still think they need another starter. I still think they need another outfielder. But, you know, it's nice to see something. Any other moves around the league that stood out to you that you think were or maybe non-moves, like guys that you're surprised are still kind of out there that you're looking at?
Not off the top of my head. I gotta think about that real quick. Anyone you have?
So I'm kind of tracking. So I think the Red Sox are mostly done with splashes. Like, I don't think they're going to be in on Bauer. Ozuna's the one I'm watching, because I think if they are going to kind of do something big, that's the guy. I think he'd be a great fit. So we'll see what happens I'm kind of surprised he isn't signed yet, especially, you know, I think all the pitchers are waiting on Bauer. I'm not surprised that we haven't seen that run on pitching yet. Obviously, Richards kind of sneaks in there quick. You have the Yankees trading for James Tallien, but I think Ozuna sooner rather than later should end up somewhere.
And there's Tanaka. Is he free? I know the Yankees there's some dilemma with the Yankees paying him. He might be a free agent. I'd love for the Red Sox to get one of these guys. Someone Tanaka is someone who's been pretty consistent. At least he's been healthy for the most part. Bauer has been healthy, although he's going to cost a lot of money But it's the Red Sox. I'd like to see them bring in another, you know, decently named, you know, to big name pitcher, especially when two guys and Chris Sale and Nathan Eovaldi are not reliable from a health standpoint. So roster as is, if Ottavino is the biggest splash, then I mean it's kind of disappointing because that's not going to be enough to get him into the postseason, in my opinion. I think they need starter.
So Blue made some comments talking about Sox prospects earlier this week. This is actually what spurred me to write that thing. Again, you check it out, 95thesportshub.com. And he kind of talked about how they're not in a position to make a splash right now. And that the goal isn't to just kind of ramp up one big run. And he wants to build a sustainable team. He wants to put a foundation in place that you can have roster turnover and still succeed and still compete every year. And I'm into that. The Red Sox haven't been consistent for 10 years. I'm not saying that like I wouldn't take what they've had. They won two titles, but in the last 9 years, they've come in first place four times and they've come in last place four times. The other time they finished in third, dead in the middle. So like they're all over the place. I think having some in terms of growing the game too, Xander Bogaerts is the longest tenured Red Sox, and that's fine. That makes sense. After him, it's Matt Barnes. And then Christian Vasquez, like guys who are young, guys who don't feel like they've been here that long. So, and I'm not counting Pedroia because he's going to retire. So, you know, I'm not saying it's easy to get franchise cornerstones, but, you know, the Pedroias, the Ortizes, like these guys aren't around. And if you want to grow the game, you need to keep players here for more than 4 or 5 years. You can't have a guy win an MVP like Mookie Betts and then trade him. And that's what Bloom's trying to build up. He's trying to put some cornerstones in place so that they can make splashes without totally jeopardizing the future of the team. So I'm all in on that. I love that.
I guess. But that kind of stinks of, you know, a small market approach with a big market team.
It's eating your vegetables is what it is.
I guess.
But here's the thing. Like, they are a big market team, but they can – it's not that they won't still make the big market moves. It's just they're in a spot right now where it doesn't matter if you're a big market team. Like, you can't sign – 10 big free agents every year, right? You have to have, like, even the Yankees, the biggest market team, they had Jeter in place. They had, you know, Andy Pettit in place. They had that the core four, right, that they called them. Even when they were out spending a ton of money in dishing prospects, they always had those guys to fall back on. That's what the Red Sox didn't have. They spent all that money in 2018, but when the other shoe dropped and there were no more prospects and no more money, there was nobody left when all of a sudden they had that 1 year where they couldn't spend. And it turned into a tailspin. So that's why I like I do think Bloom will operate the Red Sox like a big market team. But I do think whatever the market, having a core is important. And the Red Sox don't have that. Like, their core right now is Xander Bogaerts. Devers is still too young and he doesn't have an extension. Vasquez is – there's trade rumors about him every year. Benintendi's as good as gone. Bradley's gone. Like, your core is one player. That's not sustainable. That's not good. So I'm all for it. All right, we are up against it right here. We're going to do final thoughts. Real quick, for me, two things. Senior Bowl is this week. There's no combine this year. So if you're a combine nut, if you want to go into the draft informed, follow the Senior Bowl. I actually just posted my preview. It's up on 98.5thesportshub.com. It is also the one-year anniversary, of course, of the death of Kobe Bryant. And we talked about this a lot last year, but I'll just say it again. My takeaway from Kobe as an athlete, and he did a ton as a man and a ton as a father. My takeaway from him as an athlete, there are just guys, you know, there's great athletes, certainly, but there are guys who are just killers. They don't want to just beat you. They want to beat you down, blow you out, make you cry. Like, they winning by a score isn't good enough for them. They want to win by 10 scores, by 15 scores. You don't see those guys in sports anymore. Like, there's still some left over. Tom Brady, Tiger Woods. But I don't, like, maybe Mahomes has that gene. You know, I look at guys who were drafted in the last 10 years across all of sports. I don't see that killer instinct that I don't just want to beat you. I want to bury you. I want to make it so you never want to come out here and compete again. Like, Kobe had that. And that's so much fun to watch for me. Garnett's another one had that. And like, maybe there's some guys who have it, but they don't have it with the mix of elite talent that Kobe did.
Yeah.
So that, you know, that's a big takeaway for me is they don't make them like Kobe Bryant anymore. Special kind of competitor.
Yeah, it's still surreal that he's gone a year later. Such a tragic thing that happened. And it forces you to reflect on his legacy and the type of person he was. One of the greats, definitely a top 10 player all time. Some people have him in the top five. And somebody who definitely had that killer instinct that was well publicized and, you know, it led to a lot of tension. But that's what win at all costs kind of brings you. And we talked about Brady and Belichick earlier. I think you could look at that in a similar way as like a Shaq and Kobe type of thing, or maybe a Phil and Kobe type of thing. I don't know. But either way, the guy's got an unreal legacy. And you mentioned one person who kind of has a similar mindset and ability, Tiger Woods. And that leads me to my final thought. I finished the two-part documentary series. Tiger is what it's called on HBO. And it doesn't take you long to watch to realize Tiger Woods is not involved in the making of this documentary. Does not paint him in a favorable light. In it, his mistresses are interviewed. All former friends are interviewed. And it kind of gives you some insight into why he is the person he is, why he is the way he is, what led to his kind of demise from a pop culture standpoint, obviously referring to his affair back in 2009, 2010.
Affairs,
plural. Yeah. It also, in a weird way, caused you to sympathize with the guy who's been the person I think it makes look the worst wasn't Tiger Woods. It was Earl Woods and Trina Woods, his mother, and how they kind of molded this child into a golfing superstar, a symbol of hope, someone who is multiracial and a person of color in a sport largely dominated by white rich people. And he completely changed the game. And you look at somebody like Michael Jordan, who changed the way the NBA is, not only from a playing standpoint, but from a marketability standpoint. Tiger Woods' ability and the person he was transcended the game of golf and really had such a huge impact on sports from an entertainment aspect and from a marketing aspect. And I don't know. I don't think we'll ever see the same thing in the sport of golf. I also think it's kind of a cautionary tale of putting people on a pedestal and realizing like all these people have major flaws just like anybody else. And Tiger Woods was somebody who wasn't the best at coping with the real life, I guess. And he found unhealthy ways to kind of deal with that. And it caught up with him and it really, really affected his legacy. And I guess it was interesting as somebody who was young when all that stuff was kind of happening with his personal life, and I was very young when he was really in the prime of his career, to put that all in perspective and to see the context of why he was the way he was and what that scandal was about, it was incredibly interesting. And so I guess what I'm saying is I recommend everyone watch that documentary. It was very well done, and in a weird way it made me feel bad for obviously Tiger's family, his wife most of all, but Tiger Woods himself. So watch it. You should watch it this weekend. We'll discuss next week.
It's on my list. I know I need to watch it. I just got Hulu, actually. I hadn't had it because it's on Hulu, right?
HBO.
Oh, is it? Okay. Well, I just got Hulu. There's a bunch of documentaries on Hulu I want to watch, but I'll try to get there. So, I do want to check that out. Tiger's always been one of my favorites to watch, and I kind of know the story, but like you said, like we were younger, so maybe didn't know all the details, didn't understand them, had them kept from us, whatever it may be. So I definitely want to check that out. All right, that's going to do it for this week's episode. We will be back next week. We will have a Super Bowl preview. We will talk some basketball. We will talk some hockey. Baseball, if there's any more moves, like I feel weird, like I know there'll be more moves, but it's like I feel like we should be grateful for what we got after such a long offseason. But anyway, we'll be back with all that next week. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter @CallingItPodcast. You can check us out online as well at clnsmedia.com under the podcast tab. For Alex Lebowitz, I'm Alex Barth. Thanks for listening.